Vegas, baby, Vegas!
At the end of the game, you count up your money. That's how you find out who's best.
If all my bets were safe, there just wouldn't be any juice.
The point spreads, the prop bets, the teasers, the parlays. From Vegas to you, this is Behind the Bets.
Welcome back to another episode of Behind the Bets with Doug Kazarian, presented by DraftKings, America's top-rated sportsbook app. Our first golf major of the year is finally in the books here in mid-August. Colin Morikawa wins it at about 35-1, 33-1. So we'll talk with Wes Reynolds a little bit coming up. Also get maybe some winners for this weekend's Wyndham Championship. Very different course, very different field. So it'll be a lot of fun to see what kind of angles we can take there. And also UFC 232 this weekend. And it should be an exciting card. Dana White has said the winner, Cormier Miocic, will be the best UFC heavyweight ever. By the way, I said 232. I meant 252. My apologies there. So that's the main event, although we now have a co-main event. And so we're going to pull a little three-man game here with Matthew Holt's going to be back from his hiatus, and Lou Finocchiaro will return after making his podcast debut last week. So a lot of moving parts in the sports world. We had the news with college football coming out today as we tape this on Tuesday, August 11th. Obviously a setback for us sports fans and us bettors. But we move forward with the sports we do have, and we can leave those topics for Sports Talk Radio. But coming up later will be Wes. But first, we're going to get into some UFC. But before we do that, I want to remind everyone, with the much-anticipated start of the 2020 football season just around the corner, make sure you're staying up to date on all your fantasy football news with ESPN fantasy experts Matthew Berry, Field Yates, Stefania Bell, Mike Clay, and Daniel Dopp on the Fantasy Focus Football Podcast. You'll get daily strategy, previews, and injury reports to ensure you have all the information you'll need for your fantasy football team. Be sure to download and subscribe to Fantasy Focus Football and Behind the Bets on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop. Hammer time.
And I guess if we're talking MMA, we can kind of incorporate the tag team. We're going three men here for the podcast portion on the UFC 252 card. We have Matthew Holt back from his hiatus. No, we did not fire Matthew. He was jammed up, very popular, a lot of work demands. And then Lou Finocchiaro returns after his solid debut here on the Behind the Bets podcast. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Happy to be on with you, too. Thank you.
Yeah, I use the analogy of like maybe tag team. Maybe I'm the referee and you guys are more of the MMA guys, so we'll duke it out. But in all seriousness, let's start the main event. The rubber match, Stipe Miocic and Daniel Cormier. Definitive height and reach advantage for Miocic. DC's getting up there in age, but, you know, you guys are playing a little contrarian. I'll start with you, Matthew, in terms of how you see this main event playing out.
I like Miocic here, and there's several reasons why. So Miocic, throughout his entire career, has been great at making adjustments. Go back and watch the first time he fought Junior Dos Santos, a very close contested fight, split decision. JDS comes out on the right side of the split decision. Miocic on the wrong side of it. In the rematch, Miocic figured out that if he goes down the pipe with those straight punches, he's going to be able to connect on JDS, who has a slightly fragile chin. He does that. He gets the knockout win. I thought in the first fight against Cormier, he took it a little bit too fast. So although he did get the win against Francis Ngannou, I think people underestimate the amount of damage and wear and tear going five rounds with somebody like Francis Ngannou can do to your body. And that was a huge preparation for Miocic, the champion, was the underdog to Francis Ngannou in that fight. Miocic, again, came in with the perfect game plan, was able to stymie Francis Ngannou, get the win, hold on to his title, but then just 4.5 months later turns around and fights Daniel Cormier. Cormier and his camp picked up on one fact, that when Miocic throws his right hand, his left hand drops down. Cormier talked about it after the fight. It's exactly what happened. Cormier, who I thought was losing the first round up until that point in a competitive first round, lands that huge right hand, and it's history. He's the new champion. And in the return fight, Cormier was doing really well at first. And Miocic wasn't able to use that reach and height advantage, but again, they made the adjustments. That's what's so great about Miocic. He started going to the body, he wore down Cormier, and then landed those big punches. And here we are almost a year to the day later. And when Stipe Miocic has had a year to game plan for a guy, he has been really, really good. And as great as Daniel Cormier's been, extra time to game plan hasn't been advantageous to him. The extra time, the year off between the first time they fought, he lost the second fight to Stipe. He had all that time to game plan for John Jones twice and lost both fights to John Jones, including the second time where he got knocked out. I just think DC is who he is. And don't get me wrong, who he is one of the greatest MMA fighters of all time, but the extra time certainly doesn't help DC, especially since he's already battling father time at 41 years old. I think Stipe is going to come in with a good game plan. I think he's going to be the younger, fresher fighter. He has looked amazing. Everyone talks about DC's training for this fight. Go look at the Instagram photos of Stipe Miocic this week. He's ripped. I'm going to go with Miocic to get it done here, and I think if we wait a couple of days, we're going to get a plus price.
All right, so you think a plus price. Lou, where do you sit on it?
I tend to agree with much of what Matthew says. What makes me like Miocic the most is the 41 years on Daniel Cormier and what he has to do to get ready for this fight. And the fact that I really do regard him as a 205er, he's just so athletic and has such a wrestling pedigree that he's able to fight at heavyweight with his size. And so I worry about Cormier's age. What I worry about for Miocic is that while he's a very sturdy, strong wrestler, he's nowhere in the same hemisphere as wrestler as Dan Cormier is. And if Cormier comes out and sells out on his wrestling like he said he was going to do, and like I tend to believe that he needs to do to try and win this fight, then I worry that Miocic, once he gets, Cormier's proven he can take him down and stay on top of him. And if that happens, it could turn a very different side. And so rather than me try and bend my brain on which side I like here, but I will say I lean Miocic. I think for me, the value's in the under 2.5, because I think Cormier is at 41 is not going to be able to utilize and sustain a wrestling approach for that long against a guy in Miocic that's going to be that much bigger, stronger. Miocic has got 5 inches on him, a lot of reach, and while he's not the pedigree wrestler that Daniel is, he's surely a good wrestler and knows that he's going to need to use his takedown defense in this fight. So distance is how I see it, and who can control the distance will win. But I think in either way, one of them is going to get the other, and it's going to be before 2.5.
Well, we talked about it last week in terms of the tendency of these main events to go over, but we all liked the under 1.5. It got there. But, you know, Matthew, this is something you've brought up in terms of the main events going a long time. Like maybe they pace themselves with the fighters. Are you okay with an under here?
I am. I think, A, we need to look at two things. If we go back and look at every single fight that occurred in the Apex in Nevada during COVID, and then every other fight, just because, and we can do that because all the fights in the Apex are in the 25-foot octagon, all the rest of them are in a 30-foot octagon, the finishing percentages in the Apex, and we saw it again last Saturday, it's just unbelievable. It's night and day fighting in the 25-foot octagon compared to the 30-foot octagon. So that 25-foot octagon is going to force engagement. And when you have 4-ounce gloves with guys that can hit this hard anyway, almost any shot on the chin could put either one of them out. Daniel Cormier will also have a path to victory early through the submission route. If he's able to get Miocic down in the first round and lock in a rear naked choke or something, it's certainly possible until they get really sweaty. But I do agree, if Daniel goes too heavy on the wrestling, he's very likely to fatigue and fade badly in this fight. And that's going to open up the striking for Miocic. I think if you're on the Miocic side, which I am, then I'm hesitant on the under, because I actually agree with Lou that if if Daniel comes out and gets that heavy base wrestling going early, that after a couple of rounds, he's probably going to slow down a bit at 41 years old, and Miocic will probably start to take over. But does that takeover start in the third or really culminate into the fourth round at that case? With heavyweights, I don't really like to bet over 2.5 anyway. If I was forced to play, I would bet the under because you get plus money, and these are big guys that could put each other out. But I do think if you like Cormier, then you probably really need to favor the under because I don't see as many paths to victory for him in a long, drawn-out fight as I do Miocic. Whereas Miocic certainly is probably going to be the fresher guy in round 4 or 5 if it gets there, although I don't think this one sees round 5. 2.5 was a great total by the odds makers here. Instead of going 4.5 with a huge under or 1.5 with a huge over, they went 2.5. And I'll tell you that extra 5 minutes that they added from the 1.5 up to the 2.5, it really does make you think a little bit. And I thought that they did a great job of posting that number.
All right. So a couple overlapping opinions, a couple differences as you break down the analysis of the fight. Let's go next on the card. Sean O'Malley, Marlon Vera, and Matthew, if I remember correctly, you have a play here.
You know, yeah, actually, I don't on this
Lou,
one.
You do. I apologize. Lou, you have a play here.
I have a couple of strong thoughts on this fight. Mostly they revolve around O'Malley, who really has improved in each of his fights. And he's an extremely long, rangy 25-year-old bantamweight. His length and reach, his outstanding footwork, and his ability to move his head and fluidly evade strikes is savant-like. And in his 4 UFC fights, he's really looked good. However, in my estimation, the competition that he's had has been completely measured by their camp, and it's nowhere near the level of competition that his opponent, Marlon Vera, has faced. And O'Malley's going to be 3 inches the taller man. He's going to have a slight reach advantage here with his arms. And so clearly O'Malley needs to utilize distance to strike Vera, keep him at the ends of his punches, and eventually find him. O'Malley has really profuse explosive power. Vera, on the other hand, is the more well-rounded fighter who's been in with much tougher competition, a loss to Lineker, a recent loss that I don't regard as a loss to Song Yadong. Vera is going to want to crowd O'Malley and take his distance and spacing away and really make this a fight. And if he can get it to the fence or onto the floor, the advantage will go tremendously into Vera's favor. I've not seen O'Malley fight, you know, effectively into the second or third round. His fight against Andre Sukumtop was a fight Sukumtop, all he has to do is stand up and he wins. And he blew it. I sense O'Malley might have some susceptibility if this fight gets late. I believe it will get late. I like the over 2.5, which is lined at -125 or -130 right now. And Vera +250 or 260 as an underdog is also, I think, worthy of a look because O'Malley's going to have to prove it to me that he's everything that the organization wants him to be. And I know Vera's going out there off a loss on the bounce, a very focused fighter.
Sorry, I should have just let you take it, or I should have given you a heads up, Matthew. Do you have any opinion on that? We can edit this part out, but did you want to respond?
Sure. I'll jump in next time after. I just wanted to make sure that I didn't jump in over you.
I apologize. I know it's tough when we don't have, not in person.
Yeah, it's no problem. So I was thinking, I almost bet Vera myself. And what's interesting on this fight is, I did bet Marlon Vera in his last fight versus Yadong Song. And it was controversial whether or not that Vera won the fight. I thought Vera won rounds two and three after losing round one. He clearly won round three. He clearly lost round one. Round two was very debatable. I didn't think it was the worst decision loss in the world. I thought it was a 50-50 fight. I had the underdog Vera. I ended up on the losing end of a very close split decision. And I almost bet Marlon Vera again in this fight. And this is what's interesting, and this is why I think it's so great to be able to have some mind shares sometimes. And someone I used to host an MMA podcast with back in the day, I ran into him and I was talking about how excited I was for this fight and that I was going to bet Marlon Vera. And they're like, oh, you haven't learned your lesson yet, huh? And we started talking about how the UFC did such a great job of building up Conor McGregor by scheduling him the right opponents for so long in a row. And they really have done the same thing with Sean O'Malley thus far. They have scheduled the perfect opponents for him every time. So why would they schedule a Marlon Vera? And so the person I ran into said, look, I know why you like Vera, because when it gets to the third round, he's the one digging, he's the one grinding, he's the one dirtying it up, he's the fresher fighter. But go back and watch the first round of all four of his fights. So I did. I went home, I threw on my UFC TV Fight Pass, and I watched the last four Marlon Vera first rounds, including the Yadong Song fight, which I bet and lost. And he's just a slow starter. Some guys are just slow starters. And I worry here, my big fear about backing Marlon Vera is, if you're too much of a slow starter against a guy like Sean O'Malley, then Sean O'Malley could put your lights out in the first round. And we saw it with Benson Henderson in a Bellator fight here in this past week, where he kept telling everybody he was going to start faster against Michael Chandler. He was going to start faster. And I was like, there's no way, a fighter is who he is. And he did. But it also took him out of his game plan, and he got knocked out for the first time in Bellator, at least, and only like the second time in his entire career. And I wonder here, Marlon Vera has to start faster, because if he doesn't, this thing could end. He could really take some big-time damage from a guy like Sean O'Malley in the first round. I mean, go back and watch Yadong Song. Song was putting it on Marlon Vera in the first round of that fight last time. Vera's just a slow starter. And that concerns me a little bit here on both on, and I liked both the lose sides when I originally broke this fight down. I liked the over and I liked Vera, but the more I worry about that slow start, it has me off of both, because I think that there's a feeling that if he doesn't get out of the gate here with a little bit faster than he has in the past, O'Malley might put him out before he has a chance to get going. And for that reason, unfortunately, I'm going to pass on both the total and the side here.
Yeah, if I may just step in for a retort, it's my opinion that Vera is very much aware of this opportunity ahead of him, and there's fighters besides Vera in the organization that are dying to get their shot at O'Malley. If anything, I'm worried about Vera coming out too quick against O'Malley and losing his mind a little bit. He's from Ecuador, so he has that fiery personality. A slow start is what I prescribe for Vera, because I got to get this into the third round. And once it gets into the third round, I think it will get there. And I think Vera is going to have a real test in mind for O'Malley. I think he's been pointing to this fight. They've been scheduled to fight for a year. So at the end of the day, I think this could exceed the excitement that the main event is going to produce for us.
Here's something, Doug, that we haven't really ever done on this show. And I listening to Lou, it just made me think of this. Most books now, most of the big books, so let's assume that people in most states now that have access to some of these bigger sports book operators offer in-play wagering on all the main card fights of a pay-per-view. So let's assume that's going to continue here. You know what's really interesting is that there's a scenario in what Lou described where Marlon Vera, who is always a slow starter, comes out and does what Marlon Vera does. It takes him a little while to get going. It takes him a little while to get loose. And he loses that first round, maybe even gets knocked down in the first round. And now all of a sudden, a minus 350, minus 330 pre-match favorite Sean O'Malley comes out and has a big first round and goes to maybe odds close to minus 1,000, and now maybe on an opportunity where you can get plus 500, plus 600 back, maybe Marlon Vera in play after round one, assuming he doesn't take extensive damage, that could be a really good in-play opportunity. Because let's face it, I even think the Marlon Vera backers, myself included, have to assume that the first round's most likely going to go to O'Malley. I mean, you have a super fast starter against a super slow starter. But when Marlon Vera gets going, he is a lot to handle late in fights. His gas tank's never ending. He has unbelievable knees and elbows. And his jiu-jitsu submission game's a lot better than people realize when he gets you to the ground. I actually think this could make for a very interesting in-play betting proposition.
Yeah, I like where your head's at on that. I mean, that we've talked about that all the time in terms of where we, you know, it's like the one sport, unless I'm forgetting something, that in boxing that doesn't have a scoreboard. So we think we know what's going on, but to your point, this is the sort of blueprint of success for Vera. So even if he does decisively lose that first round, you know, he plays the long game, and there's no reason for him to panic, so to speak. Next fight, and you're on JDS here, Matthew, as a dog.
Yeah, absolutely. And JDS, I'll tell you, this has been a guy I have been fading routinely for a long time. But this is a little bit of a fade of Rosenstruik for me. So here we have a guy who's 10-1, 9 knockouts. But in reality, if we go back to the fight before Francis Ngannou, and Ngannou absolutely murdered Rosenstruik in 28 seconds in that fight, he was 4 seconds away from losing to Alistair Overeem and not even getting the opportunity to get mauled by Francis Ngannou. Alistair Overeem, who's not the most athletic guy, who's over 40 years old now and whose chin has let him down, was winning that fight clearly. That was going to be an easy decision win for Alistair Overeem. One right hand that I thought looked a lot scarier than maybe the damage that it actually did to Overeem, who was up, looked fine, looked cognizant of what was happening, but his lip was split in half and he looked like alien, which probably had something to do with the ref stopping. It was only 4 seconds left on the clock there. But I don't think we'd be talking about Rosenstruik at all. This is a guy that kind of came out of nowhere from the kickboxing scene. Here he is in MMA. He gets a couple of flash wins. They overbook him in a fight with Alistair Overeem. He's 4 seconds away from losing that fight in a fight that clearly exposed a lot of the weaknesses in the MMA game of Rosenstruik. But because he gets the win, he gets that fight with Francis Ngannou, and that Ngannou knockout was so fast that people almost forget it even happened. It happened that fast. But here's a couple of things to think about. Devastating knockouts like that take time to recover from. A lot of times in MMA, and I mean a lot of times, I actually had made a list, and I don't have it in front of me, that had examples of this. Guys that take devastating knockouts and then don't look good in their next performance when they come back and fight again within 3 months. There is a really good stat around that, and it's not in favor of Rosenstruik here, who just got absolutely destroyed in his last fight. And I thought the problem for JDS in his last fight, where he also didn't look all that good against Curtis Blaydes, is that he was so worried about the takedown of Blaydes. The Blaydes finally just faked a takedown, came over to the top with a huge right hand, and then it got JDS, and he was able to get the ground and pound knockdown. But this is going to be a JDS who, as far as the pictures I've seen of him, he's in the best shape I've seen him in a long time. You know, I don't want to say anything I'm not saying they should double test JDS this week, but boy, that body looks better than I've seen it in a long time for JDS. And he's only going to have to worry about the striking here. And all of his losses are by guys that are Miocic and Ngannou and Blaydes and Cain Velasquez, guys with big MMA overall games. And people forget about how much power JDS still has. He knocked out Derek Lewis. Oh, by the way, guess who's the last guy to knock out Derek Lewis? It's Junior Dos Santos. You know, he beat Blagoy Ivanov. He beat the Bren Rothwells, the Tai Tuivasa, who's another big puncher. He's been able to handle these big punchers okay. his problem hasn't been how do I handle, you know, the guys that throw one big punch. It's how do I handle these big, young, strong, athletic, all-around guys. And I think Rozenstruik, look, we all know what his key to success is here. Land that big right hand. But I'm not sure what else JDS has to worry about. If by some chance these guys run into each other and trip and go to the ground, JDS will dominate this fight on the ground. I think there's more ways to win for JDS. I like his experience and ability to win big fights. As far as I'm concerned, Rozenstruik's never won a fight against the top 15 or top 10 opponent. You know, that Alistair Overeem fight was over. He lost that decision. The ref stops it a little prematurely with 4 seconds left on the clock. I think JDS is the better all-around fighter, and I think Rozenstruik's coming back from a devastating, crushing knockout way too fast. I think JDS gets it done, and JDS gets it done early. I'm taking both pluses here. JDS plus the money and under 1.5, which actually I have to lay -110 now, so I guess I'm not getting double plus.
All right, not double plus, but you like it. I'm with you there. I think that's a good analysis in terms of the recovery from a quick knockout. And then, of course, you can always use your Fletch references, Dr. Rosen. So we're good across the board on that next fight. Lou, now you like Dotson here, another dog, and this one a little bit bigger of a payout, plus $1.75.
Yeah, what I'll start out by saying, gentlemen, is that in my opinion, and I'm going to call the fighter from the Cerro Longo gym Merab by his first name. In my opinion, Merab is, though he's ranked 14 or 15 in the division, in my opinion, he's a top 7 fighter already. And that's a division that his teammate in the same gym, Aljamain Sterling, is also the number one contender within. This Merab is from Russian Georgia. He's a wrestling dynamo. He works on complete, unrelenting forward pressure. He sells out, does everything he can do to get a grasp of his opponent, take him to the ground, and get on top and own them. He's had a couple of unfortunate losses in the UFC, or really many could regard him as an undefeated fighter. He's going to go in there and try and attack a guy in Dotson who at 36 years old is still lightning quick, has great movement power, but sometimes he's a little bit unorthodox in his mental approach to the fight. I think what's happened to him in the last few fights is that he has not taken very well to gatekeeper status. He's again put in that position with this Merab fight. And it's my opinion that Dotson is possibly the worst matchup for Merab that the division could offer him, because how well he moves, how great his footwork is, and the power in his striking. Merab's going to have to be somewhat smart in how he rushes in to try and engage Dotson, or for fear of Dotson's KO power, which we saw in his last fight. I think Dotson and Merab should be a much closer lined fight here. They're not giving Dotson any regard, not only for his wrestling. He trains at Jackson Wink, and they got plenty of wrestlers there, and he knows what to expect from this young man, nor is he getting credit for his vast experience and who he's been in with. I think Dotson's a very live dog at plus 175.
You know, I wanted to be on that side as well, and I thought this was the maybe the most impacted fight of the card, that in terms of which fight got impacted the most by having the 25-foot octagon instead of the 30-foot octagon. Because if they were fighting in the 30-foot octagon that they normally fight in, or if this was on Fight Island, I would 100% be with Lou here. I would be all over Dotson. My fear is what we have seen in the 25-footer is that elite grapplers get a hold of you a lot easier, and it's a little bit harder to avoid them. And at the end of the day, Mrab is so much bigger than John Dodson, who wasn't even a big 125-pounder. It's just that he lost to the then-champion Demetrius Johnson twice and moved up, and now he's 36 and probably doesn't want to go through the weight cut to 25 anymore. But he is not a big 35-er, John Dodson. And I just feel like in the small cage, my worry here is that Mrab gets a hold of him and just uses dominant position to kind of ride it out for three rounds.
Yeah, and I'll say that for 135-pound fighters, to me, that cage means nothing, the difference between 25 and 30 feet. I would ask whoever has the ability to check what those finishes in the smaller cage have been, and my guess would be they're at 170 pounds and higher, maybe 155 and higher, but for this small weight class, I don't regard the cage as a factor, but I may be wrong. Okay.
And I don't think, I mean, the odds tell us that this one's supposed to go the distance at minus 300. But I think that Dodson is the only one here who's probably likely to get a KO. Let's face it, I don't think Mrab, even with the heavy ground and pound, probably isn't likely to KO Dodson. We saw Dodson KO Nathaniel Wood in his last fight, so anybody who doubts he carries that power up from flyweight, he proved that wrong against a very good fighter. And to lose credit, look at the losses by Dodson. Peter Yan, the champion, Marlon Moraes, number two ranked in the division, Jimmy Rivera coming off a win, top five in the division. So, I mean, Dodson's only lost to the best in the world at 135, and I'm not sure Mirab's there yet. I personally worry about Dodson's ability to avoid the takedowns in the smaller cage, which would allow Mirab to maybe rack up some points and steal the decision.
I got to say that I just love stylistic fights where you get this kind of clash. To me, it's fascinating, and I can't wait to watch this fight.
All right, so let's hop down to the prelims. And Matthew, your play of the card is on the top row here. So I guess the last one before the main card, I should say.
So I love Vink from Hell, Pichel, and this fight against Jim Miller. And Jim Miller, you know, I've known some people that are really sharp that are kind of riding on the Jim Miller train. He's won three of four lately, although those wins, let's face it, were against Clay Guida, Jason Gonzalez, Alex White, and Roosevelt Roberts. And I love it when we have recent examples from both guys of a common opponent. So both of their last fights were against Roosevelt Roberts. Vink Pichel was a pick'em basically with Roberts, where Roberts was about a minus 360 favorite over Jim Miller in that fight and looked like he was going to put it on Jim Miller. If you go back and watch that fight, right out of the gate, it looks like Roberts hurts him, has Jim Miller down, and is going to start putting the ground and pound to him. And I think if they stay standing another 45 seconds, he knocks Jim Miller out. Instead, he follows Jim Miller to the ground and ends up in that crazy armbar that Miller throws up, and he ends up getting tapped. And what everybody who saw the fight said was kind of a fluky situation. Because it's Jim Miller, it's not necessarily a fluke, because that's what Jim Miller can do to people. But a little fluky in that it happened that way. And I don't know anyone who thought that, look, if they fought 10 times, Jim Miller would beat Roosevelt Roberts even five of those times. And the odds at almost minus 400 told us he shouldn't either. But if you look at Vink Pichel's last fight against the same fighter, Roosevelt Roberts, he clearly dominated Roberts throughout the entire fight. It wasn't some fluke one shot or a fluke thrown up armbar off a guy getting hurt. So he took it to Roosevelt Roberts, a big, long, tall, difficult guy to deal with, and beat him decisively en route to a unanimous decision. That means a lot to me. Two very recent fights against the same opponent. One guy in Jim Miller who was going to get knocked out, threw up a desperation armbar, got it. Awesome. That's what Jim Miller does. The Miller brothers are great at submissions, came out of nowhere. The other one, who was supposed to be in a good fight with Roosevelt Roberts and prove that he was the better man that night, That means a lot to me in leaning toward Pichel. And this is a guy who, due to injuries, hasn't fought enough as he should in the UFC. I mean, he's just missed so much time due to injuries, but I love that comeback fight against Roberts. He's 5-2 in the UFC, and his only losses are to Khabilov and Gregor Gillespie, and Gregor Gillespie's only lost once in the UFC to Kevin Lee, and Gillespie is an absolute beast, where he has wins over Joaquim Silva, Garrett Whitley, Roosevelt Roberts. I really like Vink Pichel here. I do think he's been a little bit susceptible to submissions in the past. One of his two losses in the UFC was a submission loss. But I think in every other way, Jim Miller has been better. So, you know, everyone says, oh, he lost all those fights in a row because of Lyme disease. And now that the Lyme disease is gone, he's winning fights again. Again, he's 3-1 his last four, but it's against an old Clay Guida, Jason Gonzalez, Alex White. He hasn't fought anybody nearly as good as Vink Pichel here. I think Pichel, as long as it doesn't go to the ground early when they're still dry and he can avoid that crazy submission, is going to chew up Jim Miller for a while. Miller will probably be really competitive in the first round, but Miller tends to gas here later in his career. And I think as Miller starts to gas late, Pichel either stops him in the second or the first half of the third round from strikes.
I would chime in by saying I'm worried a little bit about Pichel making weight. Both men 37, and I was probably leaning to Miller in this fight because I feel like he's got such a vast superiority on the mat or in the grapple. If Pichel leaves it standing and can control Miller with his distance and striking, then I think Miller has a long night if Pichel is the taller, longer man. So I don't have a strong opinion on this fight, but had I leaned Miller, or as I was leaning Miller, I'll now pass because I think Matthew makes great points in the Pichel corner.
I just think anybody who wanted to bet this fight should go back and watch, look at the odds of the two of each of their last fights, and then go back and watch the last fight, Jim Miller versus Roosevelt Roberts, how they looked against each other physically, and then Vink Pichel versus Roosevelt Roberts, because it's the most recent fight for each guy, so it really is the most recent, you know, analogy we have of how their body looks, how do they look physically, how do they look inside the octagon. And I think if you watch those two fights, you're going to probably end up on one side most of the time.
Yeah, and I think you'll come also away with an understanding. I mean, Pichel went to distance with Roberts. That's how he won it. And he did that because he stood with him. Miller subbed him because he went to the floor. And that's why I think Miller has to play the roll around in the mud game, because if he tries to stand with Pichel, he'll get cut up.
I agree. Yep, I agree.
One more fight to break down is Herbert Burns against Daniel Pineda. Yes, Burns is the brother of Gilbert Burns. So, you know, this one's pretty, like, the measurables are very comparable. Slight reach advantage for Burns. And Lou, you have another play on this one. Or actually, Matthew does.
Yeah, I think this is Matt.
I like the over 1.5 rounds on this fight. Look, I think Daniel Pineda is in a lot of trouble here, and this is the reason why. Daniel Pineda, 3 years ago, I think this would have been an amazing fight. And if you look at Daniel Pineda's career, he's been in a lot of top organizations, Bellator, the PFL. This is a guy that's been around. And what's amazing about Pineda is in 26 wins, not one of them is by decision. It's hard to find a guy with 26 wins where not one of those wins is by decisions. 8 knockouts, 18 submissions. We know Herbert Burns, how great he is on the ground, how great his submission game is here. But Pineda, with his 18 submissions, probably has the chops to hang with him. I actually thought this would be a barn burner of a fight 2 years ago. The one thing that worries me a little bit here about Pineda is his last two fights against that were in PFL, both wins, and Pineda looked great in both of those PFL fights, is he tested positive for steroids after. And he just basically came out and said, yeah, I was taking banned substances for, you know, performance-enhancing drugs, and and took his suspension like a man, kind of got a slap on the wrist for because he just came right out and admitted that, yeah, I did it, took performance enhancers and took his submission, and here he is all of a sudden in the UFC off of that suspension. Literally, this will be his first fight off the drug enhancement, performance-enhancing drug suspension. And what we have seen in the past with older guys, and he's not as old as, the Vitor Belforts or anything that we saw off PEDs, but, the body types we've seen of some of these guys that were doing PEDs and then all of a sudden aren't doing PEDs looks really different. So I think we have to look at how Daniel Pineda looks at the weigh-in. How does he look, with the stare downs on Thursday? But assuming he at least looks physically okay, I think this is going to be a fight where Herbert Burns probably wins, but he either wins in the third round late or wins it by decision. I mean, Herbert Burns is really good. I don't think he's anywhere near as good as his brother Gilbert Burns, and I think the UFC's done him a lot of favors in terms of scheduling. Look, he ended up being on a pay-per-view card last time against Evan Dunham, who was basically retired, kind of came out of retirement to fight Herbert Burns, and even Dunham in that fight for as old as Dunham is and as kind of one-dimensional as he is at this point in his career, even he landed a couple of big-time shots on Herbert Burns. Just to remind everyone that Herbert Burns' striking game is still really raw. His submission game is unbelievable, but he's still a little raw in the striking game. And I think Pineda knows that. He's a tough kid. He's going to try to keep this one standing a little bit, bang a little bit. And he does have the submission chops with 18 submissions himself, although he has been submitted several times for being really aggressive. But I think if he can come out here, this isn't going to be as one-sided as the Dunham fight was the second it hits the ground. And for that reason, and because the under is minus money here, I'm going to take over 1.5 rounds at around plus 105.
All right, guys. One final thought.
I was just going to supplement that by saying the guy that Pineda beat when he was cheating was a guy named Jeremy Kennedy, who fights in the same camp as Herbert Burns. So there's definitely plenty of motivation for Burns in this fight. Believe me, that they're planning on taking Pineda down.
Okay, so that covers the plays we like, gentlemen. I think it was fun to try something a little different, see how it plays out. Good to bounce ideas off one another, get some opinions in there. And we've talked about in other sports, and I was even on last week's podcast, I believe, if not before. Talking me off a bet is more valuable than talking me onto a bet, because you prevent the 1.1. In theory, if it's a point spread bet, you avoid the juice. So, and obviously in the money line game, it depends on what it is. But yeah, I mean, that's a valuable thing. So we'll see if we save each other money, or we talk Joff a winner, but then we can point fingers somehow. But guys, appreciate the insight. I'm glad we were able to coordinate with all of Matthew's fans and all his demands. He's so busy and most popular guy in the MMA these days.
Thanks, Doug. I appreciate it. And Lou, always a pleasure, my friend. Best of luck this weekend.
You bet. Thank you, Doug. And the same right back at you, Matthew. Good luck to everyone.
All right. Be well, guys. All right, time now to bring in Wes Reynolds. So, Wes, I had Morikawa to be the first round leader. That counts, right? The first round, right?
We give you partial credit. At least that's how it should work, shouldn't it?
What a buzzkill. No, fantastic finish. We all know about the Eagle on 16 that really decided the tournament. I thought it was pretty interesting that they put up the graphic, the topic bar, the champ, when DJ still had a couple holes left. I guess he would have had to shoot the last two holes 3 under, so highly unlikely. But I know a lot of people that bet DJ after 2 rounds. There was a lot of value out there across the board, but ultimately a 33-1 underdog hit.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, he's the deserved champion. The one thing that kept me from him, we've talked about him in past podcasts here. He's arguably the best iron player in the world right now, even though it wasn't really his irons that carried him last week. It was honestly the weakest part of his game that probably ended up sealing the deal for him, which is his putting. He was 164th in strokes gained putting on the tour coming into the PGA Championship. And it kind of proves that majors aren't always won by great putters, but oftentimes by putters who just putt great for a particular 4-day span, which he did. He led the field in strokes gained putting, but I was impressed with how good he was off the tee, because he's not a slappy short hitter, but he's not exactly a bomber either, but he was deadly accurate off the tee. I think he was 39 of 56 in terms of fairways hit, and put his ball in position to allow him to take advantage of the irons. And then he just really putted well. So look, we know that this guy had superstardom written all over him. He wins his first major at 23 and a half years old. Does that mean I think he's going to dominate the game? Not necessarily, but he's now a contender. He's now a guy you have to look at every single time, at least, and discuss whether you want to take him or not. But he's going to be probably in that 18 to 20 something to one range at most majors.
Well, that's sort of where I was going to go in with this. So now the cat's out of the bag, so to speak, with Morikawa. But you know, when you picked Rahm a couple weeks ago, you loved what he did that Sunday, and I believe it was the same tournament back to back, or same course, I should say. But you know, when you have a guy who's statistically not that amazing, just gets hot, like, what can we learn and glean from that and apply moving forward?
Yeah, and to your point, Doug, you mentioned a couple names there. We've probably had four guys at least this summer where it's like, okay, they're the best player in the world, at least today, even if they're not rated as such according to the official world golf rankings. But we remember when DeChambeau was in such that good form right away on the restart, but he just wasn't winning. But he was like 20 under par combined on aggregate, better than the rest of the field. And then he got a short price in Detroit where it was like, it's kind of, he was due for a win. He was going to win at some point. And he won up at Detroit at the Rocket Mortgage. And it's like, okay, his major price gets cut and he looks like the best in the world with what he's doing off the tee. And then we get to Memorial. Oh, by the way, John Rahm, he hasn't won a major yet, but he's only 25 years old. And he now becomes the number one player in the world. And let's not forget, at one point on the final round on Sunday at the Memorial, he was up 8 shots on one of the best fields of the year. So he's proven he can compete with the best. And then we forget Justin Thomas. He loses in a playoff to Morikawa at the Workday and then wins in Memphis against a great field. So it's like, well, this guy's won 13 times over like the last 4.5 years. So how can you not think he's the best? And now Morikawa at this point, who right now is probably the best ball striker on the PGA Tour, but it's going to keep changing, Doug. And that's what makes it fun and allows you to kind of play the market a little bit, because guys are going to go down and then guys are going to go up. And there's still a lot of players I haven't mentioned that are still great, even though they're not in great form. The Rory McIlroys, the Brooks Koepkas, the Dustin Johnson, the Patrick Reeds, Xander Schauffele, Patrick Cantlay. There's so many great players out there. So this is going to kind of keep changing. We keep waiting to see, oh my God, we're just waiting on this Tiger. Maybe there's not a Tiger. Maybe there's just a bunch of great players that are just going to keep battling it out and flipping the top rankings back and forth between them.
Well, and critics have said that this is what the game needs, right? You know, the parity, for lack of a better word. And we, you know, Tiger's domination was great in a lot of ways for ratings, but some ways it's better. The excitement on Sunday was just edgier seats excitement. So it was awesome. And, you know, Morikawa took some of the suspense out of it with that drive on the par four, but he still provided a lot of suspense and the other guys, crumbling down the stretch.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, exactly. One of my guys I had was Paul Casey, and I was texting back and forth with a little chain of golf bettors, and I was like, well, if he just makes birdie here at 17, we're still in this for those of us that had a Paul Casey ticket, because he could birdie 18, but once he knocked in the eagle, it was pretty much inevitable at that point.
Right. Question for you, and I'm playing a little bit of a, you know, annoying guy here, but, you know, you read these assessments and bio blasts of these guys, and like you said, you know, Morikawa is the best iron player in the world, and so-and-so is a great ball striker. Aren't they all awesome ball strikers? I mean, aren't they all like pretty talented iron players? I mean, how do we know? I mean, I know analytics and stats, Morikawa, but like, we didn't think he was a great putter and he putted great. So I just think it's kind of a little tricky, because no lie is the same. I know there's yardage, but everything is so different. There's so many other variables with the pressure, the wind and the other stuff. So it's just hard to really kind of make sense and generate rules of thumb with all these with all the stats.
It is, and to your point, look, I always maintain that putting is the most difficult thing to handicap because it could come and go. More often than not, ball striking is usually going to stay true, which is why I don't necessarily use stats as a crutch, but I'm always more prone to lean to consistent ball strikers than putters because, look, Jason Day, another guy I had that I mentioned on the pod last week, he was right there. And he's got, of the guys that were the contenders on that first and second page of the leaderboard, his short game is arguably the best of any of them. And that's what has kind of been his bread and butter the whole career. But he burned the edges on a few putts and didn't make enough. And you would think, okay, if somebody's going to get real hot with the putter on a major at Sunday, it's going to be Jason Day. And he never really did. So I think putting is always tough to handicap. And I think, look, these guys can hit irons great. I mean, John Rahm, that's always kind of been a little bit of the weakness, if you want to call it that, in his game, simply because he's not rated up there with the Morikawas and the Justin Thomases in terms of strokes gained approach or greens in regulation or strokes gained tee to green. But he can hit great shots. Brooks Koepka the same way. Sometimes you see him hit bad ones, and sometimes he's fantastic with the irons. So it is tough. I mean, that's why you've got to balance it. You've got to balance it with the statistical analysis and the analytics, and then plus the market, and just in terms of market price and then recent and course form. That's what always, I think, makes golf such a fascinating handicap, is that there's so many variables in which to attack the board.
All right, great stuff. And as we turn the page here, we got the Wyndham Championships. And I had to read this stat twice to really make it register. Four of the last six winners of this tournament have been 100-1 odds or larger. That sounds insane.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at long shots there.
Yeah, and to your point, seven of the last 13, so a little over half of in terms of at the Wyndham Championships since they've moved to Sedgefield, are first-time winners. You've seen like named players be first-time winners here. Webb Simpson was one of them. This was his first win on the PGA Tour back in 2011. Brant Snedeker, another one. Patrick Reed, this was his first win several years ago, back when he had his wife on the bag, and they were playing Monday qualifiers just to get into PGA Tour events for the rest of the week. So yeah, you see a lot of first-time winners. You've seen the Siwoo Kims and the JT Postens last year and the Arjun Atwals, but you've also had class players win here, who become class players, and then Sergio Garcia has won here. Really one of the only short prices to win here, I believe, was 2 or 3 years ago, and it was Henrik Stenson at like 12-1 or something around that range. So yeah, this is a good tournament to not necessarily go chalk heavy, and especially the week after a major.
Right, because and then I was told maybe you want to get in early, which we're taping this relatively early on a Tuesday evening, so some guys might pop out. Like Koepka surprisingly is playing, but some of the other guys just kind of spent from the PGA Championship you would think might drop out, or who knows. But there's a lot of names that are kind of random to some. So definitely non-golf fans are definitely random. But there's some guys that kind of catch my eye. We got, you know, I love me some triple digits. Who are you circling this week?
Yeah, and obviously just to kind of assess the top of the board, Webb Simpson is clearly going to be your favorite. His daughter, right. His third daughter of his five children is named Wyndham after the sponsor of this event. This is where he got his first PGA Tour win. He went to Wake Forest, so he's from the area. I just thought he was too low to bet at 10-1, especially at in an event where you're going to have to shoot at least 20 under to win. I think 21 or 22 under has been the winning score over the last few years. But just going down the board, and I'll go from longer odds to shorter odds, since you mentioned triple digits. A couple that I found. One is Christopher Ventura at 125-1. He's outside the top 125 right now because they're not playing for their cards this week, but they are essentially playing to get into the FedEx Cup playoffs, which starts next week in Boston at the Northern Trust. Look, Ventura is a very good putter. He is, of course, a former teammate and classmate at Oklahoma State of Victor Hovland and Matthew Wolf, who we, of course, watched last week, had a near miss at the PGA. So he's been a little erratic on the PGA Tour. He's had some good moments and then some miscuts in between. That's what you get with a rookie. But I think he could be motivated here. And then going with another triple-digit guy that has never made the cut here in three appearances, But I liked what he did last week. When you look at his finish, it's going to be deceiving. And the player I'm referring to is Luke List. He finished tied for 51st and made the cut, but wasn't really up there on the leaderboard at the PGA. But he was, I believe, ninth in the field in strokes gained approach and strokes gained tee to green. So that tells me, like as we were going back to the earlier part of the conversation, that tells me that he's hitting the ball really well. He just didn't make putts, and he was on the bent grass last week. Combined his four rounds, he lost 7.5 strokes on the greens. So if he doesn't do that and just putts at like a net zero, he's probably finishing top 15 to 20 in the event. So he gets to move to the Bermuda. I think that's a good thing. He does actually have a win in 2020, albeit on the Korn Ferry Tour at TPC Sawgrass, where the Players' Championship is usually held. But TPC Sawgrass kind of has that correlation with Sedgefield, the course this week for the Wyndham, and also Harbortown, where they played the RBC Heritage. A lot of very similar players, and a lot of the same players have won on all of those courses. Sergio Garcia, Henrik Stenson, Matt Kuchar, Siwoo Kim, Webb Simpson, all former Players' Championship winners who have either won at Sedgefield or won at Harbortown, or even maybe both in a couple of the cases. So those were guys at triple digits that I really liked. And then one that's kind of inside the triple digits, Henrik Norlander, not Henrik Stenson. We don't get the guy that won this a couple years ago, but Henrik Norlander kind of fits that profile of a guy that could be a first-time winner here that maybe a lot of people have not heard of. Norlander actually played his golf at Georgia State with Patrick Reed, a former winner here. He got back out on the tour this year. He was on the Korn Ferry last year. But he's already posted 3 top 10s. He's well within the 125, so he doesn't have the pressure of, oh, I got to go super low just to get into the playoff event next week. He can now just focus on, hey, I got to win and get a big check here. 10th in driving accuracy, 19th in greens and regulation overall on the tour. And then when you look at the strength of the field, not all those guys ranked ahead of him are in the field this week, so he actually ranks even better. So those were 3 guys that were kind of the longer shots I was looking at. And then I got some middle and shorter price guys.
Yeah, Norlander caught my eye. That was one guy I was going to be on. He's taken the last 2 weeks off, didn't get invited to the WGC or the major, but 5 straight make putts. And Bermuda grass is typically his best putting. So, you know, maybe that's where he thrives. And he historically has played well at short courses. So I think this could set up nice for him. The other guy I like, and we've got to get a, you know, triple digit in there, CT Pond. Mm-hmm. I came here 2nd 2 years ago. He just historically has done well on short courses, including the RBC Heritage in 2019. So a year ago that he won that event, he's 2nd in shots gained approach. The Workday Charity Open a few weeks ago. So he can get hot with his iron and 200-1 on a reduced field. I got to grab it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Pond is one of those guys that I also should have mentioned, former winner at the RBC Heritage, actually knocked off Chasers, I believe it was Pat Cantlay and Matt Kuchar, 2 pretty high quality players, and he was able to get out ahead of them and win that event. And the RBC Heritage that we mentioned, where it's played at Harbortown, that is a Pete Dye course, so it's not a Donald Ross like Sedgefield is this week, but there's definitely a lot of correlation there between those two.
Okay, so that's you took one of them with Norlander. And Pond was the other one. I like to fire 3 guys, usually. I'm curious who else you have in the middle and the top.
Yeah, and I usually, on an average week, will probably play about 6. Assuming it's a full field event, obviously for something like a tour championship or a shorter field, I may only play like 2 or something like that. But I ended up, I think, 7 this week. And I'll work kind of bigger price to lower price. This was one that is a narrative play. This is not a stat play or a market play or a recent form play, but he's at 80-1, Maverick McNealy. And I'm going on a motivational angle here. He is one of the better putters on tour. That's the strength of his game, is he can really roll it on the greens and get hot. Last time out, he finished 7th at the Barracuda, and I actually took him for that alternate event. It was in the Reno Tahoe area. And he was right there at the Barracuda, just didn't make anything on Sunday. And that's Stableford scoring. So if you're not making birdies, you're falling down the leaderboard. But still a good finish. But the only disappointment is he needed to win that event to get into the PGA Championship in San Francisco, which is not too far from where he grew up at in Portola Valley, California. So he had to sit at home and watch that PGA and was obviously disappointed. But he also had to watch an old college rival. McNeely, recall, played at Stanford. And Colin Morikawa was a Cal Golden Bear.
Right.
So he's got a guy around the same age that won the PGA that he played against in college. McNeely at one point was the number one amateur player in the world. And he was kind of questionable if he was even going to play professional golf because he's a rich kid. He's a son of a billionaire, Scott McNeely, the co-founder of Sun Microsystems. So he's not hurting for money. And there's not that pressure where it's like, oh my God, I got to get cash checks and make a living. He's doing okay in that regard, but he's got another bit of motivation too. He lives out here in Las Vegas with his girlfriend named Danielle Kang. And if you follow the entire golf world and follow the LPGA Tour, you know that Danielle Kang has now won in back-to-back weeks on that tour since they've restarted on the LPGA. She's now the number two rated woman's golfer in the world behind Jin Young Ko. She's top-ranked American at number two. So, look, you've got your girlfriend coming home at least with two trophies. She's still playing another event this week. So maybe it's like, hey, I got to get going. I need a fire. I need to start producing here because I'm getting shown up by some of my old college rivals and then not only my girlfriend, but and McNeely also finished tied for eighth last month at Detroit in the Donald Ross layout. So I didn't have any form to go on because he's never played this event before because he was on the Corn Ferry last year. So I took a shot with him. And then my three kind of shorter prices maybe fit more of form or angles this week.
Hold on. I want to jump in here on the narrative of the motivation.
Okay.
Because we've talked about it a lot in the pod. So like football and basketball, even like it makes sense when you are hungrier, you want it, it's going to translate to better success. I've always wondered if baseball, you can kind of harness that. It's not a contact sport. In golf, another way. So if these narratives are going to be accurate, then you're kind of suggesting indirectly that, you know, they weren't trying their best the other tournaments. I mean, if the motivation's there now.
Well, I mean, maybe not necessarily. I mean, it's really just kind of going onto an angle because, look, narrative plays, they don't always get there, but they've gotten there for me in the past. So
sure.
This is kind of just a flyer. I mean, look, he's a quality, solid player. He's well within the FedEx Cup standings. He's going to be in the top 125 already for the FedEx Cup players and playoffs. And he's not, of course, losing his tour card because they don't have those Corn Ferry finals this year. So these guys that don't make the 125 are still going to keep their cards, but they still have motivation to play for in terms of the big money with these events in the FedEx Cup. So, you know, McNeely, I'm kind of just speculating in terms of his motivation because I don't really know, but I know he's got a lot of money. So it's not like he's just the total grinder that's like, I got to support my family. And he's a young 24-year-old guy that's the son of a billionaire. So it's not like, well, I got 3-4 kids to support. I got to get some top tens and make some money out here so I can provide for them. So that's more of kind of just a speculation. But sometimes those storylines have a way of coming true. It's just kind of a funny way it works out that way.
Gotcha. And I'm glad. I just wanted to challenge you that because it's something that I've wrestled with a lot in this space. I'm very curious how it all kind of manifests itself. What are some of the other guys? I interrupted you. You were heading towards other guys. Leave your card.
No, that's okay. Joaquin Niemann, who's around the 50-1 range. He did miss the cut last week, but that's not always a bad thing. 5 of the last 10 winners at this event either missed the cut or withdrew the week or the event before. But Niemann is one of those guys that do kind of fit that profile I talked about where you've got the RBC Heritage correlation and the Sedgefield correlation. Earlier this summer, he was 5th down in Hilton Head for the RBC Heritage at Harbortown. He shot 128 on the weekend, which was 14 under, which was tied with Daniel Berger, who had actually just won the week prior at Colonial. So that was tied for the best in the field on the weekend. He also had a tied for 5th last year at the Rocket Mortgage Classic at the Detroit Golf Club, which is also another similar birdie fest Donald Ross design to what they're going to get at Sedgefield. So also he raced 8th overall on tour and 3rd in the field this week for strokes gained approach and 8th in this week's field for tee to green. This is not necessarily a bomber type course. This is a course where accuracy is going to matter and hitting greens are going to matter, because these Bermuda greens are a little bit smoother, and some guys putt better on the Bermuda. Some guys like the grainy, more bent grass Poa Anwa that they saw last week. But I think Neiman is a guy that could go really well here, kind of in that middle range. And I would apply the same around the same price with Russell Henley. And Russell Henley last week played the PGA, wasn't a contender, but if you look at the numbers, only Paul Casey, Jason Day, Tony Finau, and Matt Wolff were better in strokes gained approach than Russell Henley at last weekend's PGA Championship. And by the way, those guys finished second in Casey's case, tied for second, and Wolff, Day, and Finau finished tied for fourth. So if he's hitting it as well on approaches as those guys, he's doing at least something right. He's fourth overall on tour in the category. The only three guys that rate better overall on the tour than him are Justin Thomas, Colin Morikawa, Paul Casey. All guys that are pretty good in the fairways with the iron in their hands. So he fits those boxes in terms of maybe the statistical type of player that you're looking for. But the weakness was the putter, because last weekend on the bent grass out at Harding Park, he lost four strokes overall for his four rounds. But he's better on the Bermuda. He always has been. That's where all of his wins pretty much on the PGA Tour come from. So he's always been one of the better putters on Bermuda. So I got a feeling he could go low. The shortest price guy I played was a little north of 30-1, and that was Harris English. And this was a little bit more of a form play. Tied for 19th last week at the PGA. That gave him his seventh top 20 or better finish in his last eight events. That dates all the way back to Phoenix back in February. Really went well in the fall series. Once the FedEx Cup ends, and then they kind of do that wraparound season now. So they start usually the tour in the fall, and then got slow out of the gate once the season ended around December, and was slow out of the gate, had a couple missed cuts, but then he started that run in Phoenix and had a top 10 at the Arnold Palmer before obviously the pandemic happens and the tour gets shut down. So when he started back up, he missed the cut at Colonial, but then he kept posting these really good finishes. And English has always really spoken very well. He's from kind of that southeast area in Sea Island, Georgia. So he's always loved the RBC Heritage, favorite stop on tour. And as we mentioned earlier, correlation between the RBC Heritage and the Wyndham. So I think maybe with a weaker field this week, even though you've got some class players at the top, it's not overwhelming. So I think he probably has some confidence that, look, I'm just a week away. I keep knocking on the door. I keep getting these decent earning checks and getting top 20s and whatnot. So he comes in with some momentum. He's top 10 in the field this week in terms of strokes gained putting, strokes gained tee to green and greens in regulation. Shot 66 rather, 4 under on Sunday at the PGA, which was the fourth best round in the field. And he shot basically the same round that John Rahm, Bryson DeChambeau, Tony Finau, Paul Casey, Jason Day, and Patrick Reed shot. So that's pretty darn good company. So he came in with some momentum. And look, this is the type of event where there's no real clear-cut favorite, even though Webb Simpson pretty much is because of his course form with a win here, two runner-ups, and a third in the last 3 years. There really isn't that overwhelming dominant player that it's like, okay, that guy. So that's where I think it opens it up for middle price guys like a Harris English, where he thinks he can go well. And it's like, well, a lot of the big guns are staying home. I got a chance to get back in the winner's circle. And I think he maybe could be a guy who can take advantage of it.
Fair points. The only other guy I would add is I'm considering Brendan Todd in that sort of like favorite range, if you will, besides Webb Simpson, of course. He's around 40-1. He's won or twice already this year. He's so solid, and I trust his game here, even though he's not a household name. So he's the other guy I'm considering getting involved with. But that's about it, man. That's all I'm managing so far. And you got your six guys. And let's try to get back in the win column, Wes. What do you say?
Yeah, absolutely, man. I feel I had the leaderboard peppered last week, but just didn't get the first place. Felt like a SWAT team that's got the perp surrounded and the perp gets away. Because we didn't end up landing on the winner. But starting anew this week, moving on to Greensboro.
The SWAT team reference. I like it. There's a lot of ways you're going to get gone with that, but you went SWAT team. I like it. All right, buddy. Have a good week. Good luck. And we'll catch you another next time.
All right, Doug. Thanks for having me on. Always a pleasure, man.
Likewise.
Kicking is for losers.
All right. So we got a couple opinions back and forth in the UFC world. Good to get Wes back. Break down this tournament, as we say often. All tickets cash the same. So if we can pick a winner this weekend, it's the same as essentially picking the winner last weekend, right? It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be the majors we cash our tickets in. We can do it at the tournaments like this, the Wyndham. So great stat, by the way. Webb Simpson's third child named after the Wyndham tournament. But any parting shots for our listeners as you've been able to, as sports trickling back into our worlds, although we do starting to lose college football here?
It is very unfortunate we're starting to lose college football, but I mean, at least we still have golf and UFC to focus on.
We do, and the NFL around the corner, and obviously bubble life working well for both the NBA and NHL. So congrats to them. Tip of the cap to them. They are carrying the torch. We have playoffs next week. The Suns are doing amazing work. They've covered and won every game so far, entering this game here on Tuesday with Philly, but 200-1 long shots to make the 8th seed, which is just crazy for the Suns. Okay, that's going to do it for this podcast. Good luck to everyone this weekend, and let's keep our fingers crossed for all sports.